info@wpfw.org.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Is there an orange jumpsuit in Donald Trump's future? A look at the legal options available to the former U.S. president. And gray divorce. What's causing a couple to choose to spend their twilight years without their life mate?
Good morning. Welcome to What's the Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, when the jury's verdict was announced last week and former President Donald Trump was convicted of 34 felony counts, there were basically three reactions. One, total glee and euphoria, a lot of fist pumping in the air. They finally got that. Well, you know the rest of that. Or two, rage, disgust, and threats. The Civil War just began. We no longer live in a democracy. Or three, he'll never do 1 minute of prison time. And of course, there were variations in between. Trump himself insisted the real verdict will be at the ballot box in November. And ironically, many progressives agree with that. This morning on What's at Stake, we're going to examine the perfect execution of the hush money case against Trump and the man who orchestrated it, and the uncertain legal journey that lies ahead. Is there an orange jumpsuit in Trump's future? Can he really govern the country from the big house? And what can law-abiding citizens help on preserving our democracy actually do to prevent him from returning to the presidency? Joining me in the Zoom studio this morning are three individuals who've been closely following this case and will help me unpack some of the burning questions on everyone's mind. Darryl D. Jones is a former prosecutor, a criminal defense attorney, and chairman of the board of the Transformative Justice Coalition, a nonpartisan organization founded by renowned civil rights leader Barbara Arnwine. And it seeks to achieve racial, gender, social, and economic justice through public education and engagement initiatives. Welcome, Attorney Jones.
Thank you so much, Vera. So great to be with you this morning.
Yes, indeed. We're happy to have you. And John Nichols is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He has written, co-written, or edited over a dozen books on topics ranging from histories of American socialism and the Democratic Party to analysis of U.S. and global media systems. His latest co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders is the New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. And I might add that he's a longtime guest on Pacifica Radio. It's probably been decades, has it not, John Nichols?
I am afraid, Verna, that it probably has been decades, but it's all been a pleasure, and it's an honor to be with you and everyone else this morning, especially my good friend, Darryl.
Oh, good. You guys know each other. Okay, fantastic. I guess quality people sort of negotiate in the same circles. Okay, and we have Sulma Arias, Executive Director of People's Action, a national network of state-based power-building organizations across the U.S. Her 20 years of organizing experience includes immigrant rights, voting rights, economic justice, and centered directly impacted people to build power. People Action is focused on reviving the craft of community organizing and beating back authoritarianism in 2024. Sulma Arias, welcome this morning to What's at Stake.
Thank you, Verna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, indeed. And beating back authoritarianism, I guess you got yourself, you got your plate full.
We sure do.
So former prosecutor Darryl Jones, let's get, what's your reaction? What was your reaction to the verdict? Were you surprised? 34 counts, guilty, 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 guilty.
You know, Verna, I can say I was somewhat surprised. I wasn't quite certain what the jury was going to do. I was perhaps even more surprised at the speed at which the jury moved to getting to the convictions. When I heard that a verdict had been reached, the question I immediately asked myself was, well, what do you think this verdict is? And the more I thought about it, I said, you know, in order for it to be a verdict means that it had to be unanimous, that all 12 people had to agree on this. Oh. And there was no way I could imagine all 12 people agreeing that he was not guilty of something. So I was anticipating some guilty finding. When it came back all 34 counts, I was simply astounded that they came on all 34 counts and they become felonies. So, you know, I certainly want to take a moment to, you know, congratulate and commend the jury for the job that they did in going through the evidence and taking some steps that our Supreme Court, right, it was unwilling to do in terms of holding people responsible. But in addition, I want to take a moment to congratulate Alvin Bragg, the prosecutor in Manhattan, because when he brought this count, there were not many pundits that were in favor of what he was doing, that supported what he was doing, that said he didn't know what he was doing. And now he stands in the winner's circle, having accomplished what he sought out to do to protect the rights and the interests and the laws of the citizens out of Manhattan and New York. So, you know, certainly congratulations to him. But yeah, it was surprising with regards to all 34 counts, Verna, absolutely was.
So all 34 counts falsifying records to cover up a $130,000 payment to adult porn star Stormy Daniels. What do you say to those people, Daryl, who say he won't spend the day in prison?
Well, first, they have no idea what Judge Marquand's going to do. Okay. I understand where they're coming from, where they're saying he won't spend a day in prison. I say not so quick, you know, slow down for just a moment. Because, you know, typically, you've got to remember, a lot of people are saying that this is such a nuanced case and all this. It's not a nuanced case, right? Falsifying business documents is not nuanced in New York or any other state. It's a very common occurrence in terms of charges that are brought. What changes here is now we're looking at not one count of falsifying business documents, but we're looking at 34 felony counts of falsifying business documents. Even though they're lower level felony counts, what people have to remember is this. When we get to the point of sentencing, we're now talking about, has the defendant shown any remorse? Has he taken responsibility for what he's done? What has he done in his behavior to merit the treatment of having some type of non-incarcerable remedy imposed? It goes deeper than that too, Verna, because, and I tell people to hold the line, hold up. Why? Because of this, all right? Not only do we know about the attacks on the judge, attacks on the judge's family and all this other stuff that be considered, but let's understand this. The way they got to the felony charges was that they said there was a cover-up of another crime. That this was in furtherance of another crime. That crime in New York was the violation of New York election laws, okay? So, and in violation of the New York election laws, what was the benefit he got from this crime? The benefit he got from this crime was that, and we don't know for certain, but we know that where John Nichols is in Wisconsin, the victory there was not by much. In Michigan, the victory was not by much. In Pennsylvania, Georgia, the victory was not by much. So the benefit of what he received as a result of the lying and the false documenting of the records, it isn't as simple as saying he just falsely entered the business documents, but the impact of what he's done on the presidential election in the United States. That's why I say not so quick, because Judge Marquand is going to look at all of this and he's going to weigh it. And that's how that decision is going to be made.
Okay. But the narrative, as you know, is, well, he's a 77-year-old man with no prior criminal record. Those are low level felonies. And he's a former president of the U.S. Let's put him on house arrest.
You know, that's one of the options that that Judge McCann is going to have. And it's going to be interesting because, you know, what judges will do is they're going to do a balancing test, right? Because this is, you know, criminal law is not a science, right? You don't put in, you know, A, B, and C, and you come out with D, E, and F. It's going to be much more a balancing test that goes by, you know, what the judge feels at the moment with regards to what he believes is the appropriate thing to happen with regards to a sentence. You're absolutely right. We're dealing with a 77-year-old gentleman. It's a low-level felony, no prior criminal record. All of those things certainly weigh in his favor of a suspended sentence, of maybe home detention or something like that. But when you look at the counter side of that, you know, the countervailing side, the impact that it's had on the country, the impact that it's had on the election, the benefit that he's received from it, that's when you start to try to figure out where the judge is going to land, and it's unclear. So that's why I say not so fast to say it's going to be a simple probation case, not so fast to say he's going to be simply on house arrest. Judge Marquand has shown himself to be a very balanced judge that's in control of his courtroom, even-tempered, even-keeled, and a clear, good applier of the law. So it's going to be interesting to see what he does on the sentencing side.
So if he was not the former president of the U.S., 77-year-old man with no prior convictions and had been found guilty of 34 felony counts, what chance would he have of avoiding jail time?
If he were not 77 years old and a former president and had no prior record?
No, if he were 77 years old and not the former president.
And not the former president.
Yes.
If he, you know, I think Judge Marquand and the jury did a great job of depoliticizing all of this. So I don't think he's going to put a bunch of weight on the fact that he's a former president. I don't. I think he's going to look at the individual, he's going to look at the crime, and he's going to impose a sentence that's appropriate for a 77-year-old man. That's what I think it's going to be based on. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, you know, that multitude, the impact, that's what I would be most concerned about if I were representing Donald Trump.
Okay, so one or two more questions, and we're going to get to John and Suma. So now, even if the judge were to sentence him to jail time, talk to us about Trump's appeal process. Could he reach the Supreme Court before Election Day in November, which is just 5 months away?
No. It's not going to reach the Supreme Court within 5 months. You know, his first right of appeal would be to the New York appellate court, and could eventually get to the highest court in New York, where they would schedule arguments, they'd have arguments, and ultimately either, you know, hold or whatever the verdict and the decisions that were made in the case. So he doesn't go. There's no direct appeal to the Supreme Court from a trial court in the state level, in the state system.
So not going to happen before the election.
It ain't going to happen before the election. You would be lucky to get through the New York appellate system before the election occurs.
Okay. And even to get to the court, he has stacked the court with his judges, and Justice Samuel Alito has refused to recuse himself from any Trump case, even though there were MAGA flags flying outside his residence after the January 6th insurrection. Does the law say anything about when a justice must recuse him or herself from a case?
You know, Vernon, you're hitting on all buttons today. I don't need a cup of coffee. You keep asking questions like that. let me tell you, you know, when it comes to the Supreme Court and what Justice Alito and Justice Thomas have not done, right, by not recusing themselves in cases where they know that their spouses, at a minimum, their spouses have put them in a precarious position where, you know, they have the appearance of an impropriety. They have appearance of being involved. They have appearance of being biased. You know, automatically, any other judge would recuse themselves from the case. They're not doing it. So it does create a problem. But the attorney general, and actually any of the assistant attorney generals that are handling the case, they actually can take a stance too, because they can make the motion that the judges be recused from hearing those cases of the former president because of their actions, and require a hearing that those two judges couldn't sit on and listen in and make the other justices make that decision. That's the position that I think should be taken by the U.S. Attorney General.
Okay. All right. And final question before I move on to John and Salma. Most people are shocked to learn that Trump can actually run for president as a convicted felon and could theoretically serve as president if elected, and if it came down to it, could govern from prison. Help us understand why such a preposterous possibility exists in the world today.
Well, you know, the thing to remember that to run for president, you got to be 35 years old and a natural born citizen of the United States. That's it. That's the only requirement. So he can run, he can be elected and be in place. Now, in certain states, because of the felony convictions, he may not be able to vote. So, you know, that would present that type of situation. But in terms of running for office, there's no prohibition of a person being convicted of a felony from running for office. We have a member in Congress that's been convicted of a felony out of Florida that is certainly in the U.S. House of Representatives now. So there's no prohibition against him running. There's no prohibition against him being elected. A bigger question in my mind becomes, number one, do we want a convicted felon running our country? But a bigger question that comes in our mind, certainly in my mind, becomes when we start talking about security briefings and top secret clearance. Because when we get to top secret clearances, typically people that have financial problems, people that have convictions, people that have felony convictions, they don't get top secret clearance to be able to get the nuclear secrets and other secrets that could impact and have stuff on the United States. He would, in this situation.
He'd be a toothless tiger. Okay, John Nichols. Now, we are venturing onto uncharted territory. No historical precedents for this. History was made by a Manhattan district attorney named Alvin Bragg, as we've noted. He carved out his place in history with one victory, and it seemed like an overnight success, but in reality, it took place over a number of years, did it not? Can you give us a little background on Bragg's encounters with Trump over the years, John Nichols?
Well, of course, and thanks, Verna, for focusing on Bragg, because I think that as Daryl has suggested, Alvin Bragg comes out as a real hero in this struggle. And more than that, as a counterweight to a lot of the cynicism and to a lot of the frankly false narratives as regards prosecuting Donald Trump. Alvin Bragg is one of the most experienced prosecutors in the United States. He's an incredibly skilled lawyer who has worked at the federal, state, and local levels. His resume blows your mind, right? And he is also an elected prosecutor. He wasn't picked by some cabal. There wasn't some, you know, backroom group of people that decided to, you know, go this route to go after Trump. Alvin Bragg took all of his experience. He ran for the open seat of district attorney in Manhattan. And he said he was going to work on primarily criminal justice reform to try and bring some fairness to an unfair system. But when asked, he said, yes, I'm going to actually apply the rule of law. I am going to prosecute people not based on, you know, like their class or their race or their gender or, you know, who they know or how connected they are. If they've committed a crime, I'll go after them. If they haven't, I won't. Right. Mm-hmm. He was very straight about this.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, John. Go ahead.
This core thought. Mm-hmm. And that included the wealthy and powerful. Right. That's a big deal. And it's one of the reasons why this effort to reform our prosecutions in this country, to elect independent, progressive prosecutors who are willing to apply the rule of law to the wealthy and powerful is such a big deal. Alvin Bragg won on his experience and on his commitment to go where the law told him to go. And that's what he did with this case. And he was savaged for it. He was attacked for it. He was brutalized in the media. If you look at how Fox News covered him and other media outlets, it was horrific. They tried to paint him as inept and in so many negative lights. Jim Jordan, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, actually brought a hearing of the committee to New York to try and besmirch and attack Bragg to suggest he was doing a terrible job. Trump himself has attacked him again and again and again. Lies with deceit, etc. And the interesting thing about Alvin Bragg is that when you got to this final days of this trial, remember, he had a team. He brought in the best prosecutors. Mm-hmm. He sorted through the many cases. He didn't follow some tracks. He picked up other ones. But he quietly came to the courtroom in those last days. He sat there, you know, with his notes and that. He didn't make a big deal. This isn't a guy who was trying to grab the cameras. This is a man of the law following the law. And that is why, Verna, when all these great questions you just asked, Daryl, that is why this case is going to hold up. That's why when you go through the appeals, this is going to stand strong. It is because you have a great lawyer who was willing to go after the wealthy and powerful and who knew that when you go after the wealthy and powerful, you got to build your case double, because the system isn't fair always. And so he did build his case double, and he won this epic victory.
Well, you know, critics say Bragg targeted Trump for political reasons, and he campaigned on promises to hold Trump accountable. First of all, it seems to me that he did sort of campaign to hold people like Trump accountable for their crimes, for their crimes. And second, isn't that exactly what he's supposed to do as a Manhattan district attorney?
That's exactly right. And look, this is an interesting thing when we talk about politics. You could say, and I think that if we're honest about this, everything weaves back to politics, right? Politics is a defining factor in, you know, our public life, right? And yes, there are our partisanships and ideologies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing to understand about Alvin Bragg is that he didn't say, I will go and get Trump no matter what. He said, if there are violations of the law, I will pursue them as far as I can, right? I'll do what I'm supposed to do as a prosecutor. That's what we want in every prosecutor. We want every prosecutor to say, look, if there are concerns about an individual, if there are concerns about a corporation, if there are concerns about someone or some entity that's powerful, just because they're powerful, I'm not going to look away, all right? I'm going to keep focused on it, and I am not going to treat them unfairly, but I am going to make sure that the law applies to them. Now, and that's what Alvin Bragg said.
So he actually put the Trump case on pause when he first took office, and that caused some of his staff to quit. Why did he do that, John?
Sure. Look, I mean, this is one of the complaints. I grew up in a courthouse. My dad was in the district attorney's office in Racine County, Wisconsin. He was then the court commissioner of the county. And so literally my babysitting was running around the courthouse in Racine County. And so I was around a lot of judges and a lot of prosecutors when I was a little kid. It's probably warped me in all sorts of ways. But the thing to understand is that a good prosecutor is judicious. Right. It's not just the judge that's judicious, it's the prosecutor as well. And so Alvin Bragg replaced a prosecutor who had had some fits and starts as regards prosecuting Trump. There have been people in the office working on it, but there have been a lot of lack of clarity about, you know, kind of where they're going, how they're going to go. Some good cases built, but maybe not built in the ways that Bragg thought was correct. And so what Bragg did was do what any responsible prosecutor would do. He put things on pause. And he said, look, I'm going to look through all this information. This is a big deal. We're prosecuting a former president of the United States. It's going to be very high profile. We're going to be attacked from left and right. So he looked at the cases. He looked at the issues. He looked at the law, along with his very incredible team. Remember, that prosecutor's office in Manhattan is sort of a first among equals in the country. It's a very, very well-staffed office. And so they looked at everything. Some people were upset with the pause. Some people were upset, you know, that they took that time. But at the end of the day, I guess it's fair to say, as Daryl has suggested, that the proof comes in the result, right? You take your time, you go through things, you choose your 34 counts that you want to take forward, you build the case on those counts, you may discard some that are not going to stand as strong, because you don't want to lose. You want to win. Once you're taking a case to trial, you want to win. So that's what happened here. And again, what I'll emphasize is this prosecutor was attacked from the right and even from the left. Even some liberal pundits said, oh, he shouldn't go first because it's this, you know, case about a porn star, or it's all this other stuff. What Bragg reminds us is that when you're going after the wealthy and the powerful, right, you often have to find those areas of vulnerability, those spaces where they have broken the law, and you build on that. And this was not, and I know I don't want to over talk here, so I want to get quick and just say this one thought here. This was not an inconsequential case. Okay. This was a case about trying to deny the people of the United States information at election time that might influence or help them to make a decision. And so this is a big deal case. Alvin Bragg pursued it aggressively, and he succeeded.
Salma Arias, executive director of People's Action. Trump said that the real verdict will come at the ballot box in November. Do you agree?
Well, absolutely. I agree. And it's just really good to hear the legal and history perspective from both Daryl and John. I think it's just, I mean, I think millions of Americans whom we organize across 30 states were watching. And these are people, like, remember that there is a moment in this country where a lot of people are even doubting, like, does the system even work? You know, do we, you know, what does it mean for how I become engaged in changing the direction of this country? And what we observed as we were watching this play out on our TV screens is that, wow, it actually worked. A lot of people were surprised that it even got to that point. So, but for us, it really reminds us that it worked. And we are banking on that, helping people organize themselves into, look, this is where we can really impact change at this moment. And we must, all of us can now use our vote and beat him at the ballot box, because the simple fact remains that he's still running for president. And if he wins, you know, on above everything else on this case in particular, he would likely pardon himself, pardon everybody else. You know, he's already stacked the courts, as we heard. So this, for us, is very clear that while we celebrate and watch what's been playing out, that, you know, it's still, we have a choice between two futures. One in which, you know, we have a corporate takeover of the country and a would-be dictator at the at the helm, or we have a future in which working class people can build a multiracial democracy in which we look out for each other and we look out for the well-being of everyone. And so organizing for us is what we're betting on, right? We're saying that organizing makes a difference, and we won't take our eye off of that ball, because at the end of the day, for us, you know, we need everyone in this moment who cares about families, about freedoms and our future for us to join the fight, because greedy corporations are the source of this pain. Rich people who are really out of touch with what everyday people in this country are dealing with is what the hope for us is, to organize as people into really creating the country that we need. And in this moment in particular, making our vote count.
Now, incidentally, Trump claims he was just joking about being a dictator. And I didn't ask Daryl about the Kenny pardon himself, but maybe we'll get to that. But of course, the strategy, Selma, has to be to get the voters to the polls. But do you have a specific strategy in different parts of the country? For example, Arizona is one of seven so-called battleground states where Dems and Republicans have similar levels of support. Trump says he will seek to deport some 10 million undocumented workers out of the U.S. How's that going over with Latino voters in Arizona, a battleground state where immigration is a key issue? And they have 11 electoral college votes up for grabs, by the way. What's your strategy? How are you all doing that?
Yeah, so our political strategy and our political program is really an extension of what we call an organizing revival, right? And at People's Action and the 30 states that we work in across the country, we really are voting on the terrain that we want to work in the next 4 years. Like, what is the terrain? What is the landscape in which we will be organizing? So our political program is an extension of what we call an organizing revival. We're betting on people. We're betting on having hundreds and thousands of organizers talking to their neighbors. And really, like, at this moment, the relationship, what we call Deep Canvas, which is a training we do every month to train people on how to talk to others, even those who don't agree with us. Because at the end, and like, we believe that the only way and the best strategy for countering all the misinformation is actually getting out and talking to our neighbors and talking to people, sometimes people who don't believe like us. So, you know, in 2024, we plan to talk to 450,000 people in Deep Canvas conversations in battleground states out of, you know, all the states. We're diving deep in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So those are the three states where we're going to go deeper on and really focus a lot of our electoral plan this year. But this is just the beginning. We're a national organization, and we're made out of, you know, state-based member organizations. So we're working with them to grow their own membership and base and to run candidates and issue campaigns that can win at the local level. So many other campaigns.
Okay, for some reason, Salma's camera has frozen. I wanted to ask.
I think she might be back.
Okay. Salma, are you there, Salma?
I'm here. Okay. Yes, I'm here.
So let me ask you this. The Biden administration's support is actually dwindling because of his administration's support of Israel's genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Have you encountered that sentiment? And if so, how do you address that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the, you know, we have called for a ceasefire, and we believe that, you know, there's a lot more that the president can be doing and could be doing. And that, you know, the president, in addition to addressing a lot of most important issues, should really be addressing the lives and the dignity of Palestinian people. He needs to realize that this is causing a lot of pain and disillusionment in the base. President, he just really needs to do more. However, at the same time, we come at this from a power analysis. And so we're looking, again, what is going to position us to really deliver over the next 10 years and 20 years what we need. And the reality is, when we look at both terrains, a Trump terrain and a Biden terrain, we look at what Trump has promised. He has promised to crush pro-Palestinian protests and deport demonstrators. He, you know, he tells donors that he supports Israel's the right to continue its war on terror. So when you really put a power analysis in what terrain, Trump still looks a lot worse than Biden.
Okay. Salma Arias, Executive Director of People's Action, John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, and Daryl Jones, former prosecutor and chairman of the board of the Transformative Justice Coalition. Thank you all for being my guests this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so much, Verna. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Yes, and with everyone else.
We enjoy it. Well, when we come back, divorce rates among baby boomers is skyrocketing. But we speak with one couple that has beat the odds, 50 years of marriage and still smiling and dancing, I might add. Back in 60 seconds.
Saturday marks 8 months of U.S.-Israeli genocide of the Palestinian people. A month ago, Biden said that the invasion of Rafah was a red line. But now the invasion of Rafah has continued for weeks, has expanded to the entire Gaza Strip. Instead of following through and stopping military aid to Israel, Biden has authorized billions more in weapon shipments to be used to kill and massacre Palestinians. Biden can draw the line, but we can. On June 8th, we will come together from across the country and surround the White House wearing red and raising our demands high. We will show the world that we are the red line. We demand an immediate ceasefire, an immediate end to the siege on Gaza, the freedom of all Palestinian prisoners, and an end to the occupation of Palestine. Viva Palestina Libre.
ShutItDownForPalestine.org.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm still Verna Avery Brown, and Dr. William D. Jolly, host of the Jolly Marriage Show, have termed the noticeable rise in broken marriages among baby boomers gray divorce. They have stumbled across some eyebrow-raising statistics with regard to aging couples splitting up. Dr. Jolly, of course, is an author, a radio host, speaker, singer, and media personality, best known for his motivational best-selling book, If It Only Takes a Minute to Change Your Life. He was named as one of the outstanding 5 speakers in the world by Toastmasters International. Dee Taylor Jolly, along with her husband, Dr. Jolly, has co-authored the book, Make Love, Make Money, Make It Last, 10 Secrets to Shape a Great Marriage. In his insightful book, the Jollies have shared personal secrets they've learned, as well as wisdom from other couples who have been happily married for over 30, 40, 50, and even 60 years. And also joining us in the studio this morning is baby boomer couple who navigated the terrain of marriage and avoided the treacherous pitfall of divorce, Ty and Pam Harris. Tyrone, Ty,
Harris Esquire is an American University alumnus. He earned his Juris Doctor from the Washington College of Law. Ty was part of the first Frederick Douglass Scholars Program at AU, a program that provided academic and funding support for students in Washington, D.C. He was founding member of the AU radio program known as Spirits Known and Unknown, and he fondly recalls marrying his AU college sweetheart, Pam Higgins, in a candlelight service at the K Spiritual Life Center. The couple is celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary this month. And Pamela Higgins Harris is a former senior consultant, Center for Education Equity. She has over 50 years of experience in public education and higher education, serving in roles that have embedded her commitment as an education equity leader. Her work has always focused on balancing while elevating the academic, social, emotional, and socio-cultural needs and interests of diverse, underrepresented, underserved, and marginalized learners, ranging from pre-K to adult, as well as the stakeholders who serve them. Welcome to all of you. Good morning, Dr. Willie and Dee Jolly and Ty.
Good morning.
Pam, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Beautiful people. I understand you guys actually know each other and had no
idea. Do we know each other? Oh, yes, we do. This is American U conclave here today. I mean, this is American U alumni conclave. But first, for those who know me, I always thought I have only just a minute, only 60 seconds in it, forced upon me. Can't refuse it, didn't seek it, didn't choose it, but it's up to me to use it. I must suffer if I lose it, give account if I abuse it. Just a tiny little minute, but our eternities are wrapped up in it. So I'm grateful for this minute, this moment, this opportunity to be on with my dear friend, Verna Avery Brown, and my dear friends and people who give the best house parties in the world, Ty and Pam Harris. They give the parties for life.
Don't miss it.
We've been all of us have been friends for over 30 years and came out of American University, except for my wife, who is a Howard University graduate. But
we won't hold that against her.
The Harris family. Harris family is iconic at American University because they have a legacy of all the brothers and sisters going there, from Joe to Ty to Mark, my classmate, and to their beautiful sister as well. So we're grateful to be here and talk about marriage and how to do what Ty and Pam have done. And we're getting ready to celebrate their 50th soon. We're going to have a big party. But what we want to do is highlight how so many others are going the other way. Now, many people know my wife and I wrote a book called Make Love, Make Money, Make It Last. We've been married for going on 39 years. In a couple weeks, we'll be 39 years. Haven't had an argument in over 37 years.
And that makes me wonder. I know
people always wonder about that. But we were on the Today Show promoting the book, and people said on the Today Show, "You've never had an argument." I said, I didn't say we've never had an argument. I said we haven't had an argument in 37 years. Those first couple of years were like World War III. Okay, but we learned some wise principles from some wise marriage mentors who taught us how to stop arguing and get to loving. We used those principles. They worked. We put them in a book, and the book now has become a bestseller. Now, we know that of marriages in America, 50% of marriages in America break up because of divorce. And of the 50% that remain, statistics show that 40% of the people in that marriage that remain are miserable. They only stayed because of the children or because of financial issues. They couldn't leave. So we want to help do what Ty and Pam have done. Now, one more statistic we want to share, which you've brought so wonderfully, Verna, is the highest number of divorces now in America are the gray divorce. 50% of regular people are divorcing. Over 65% of people who've been married for 30 years or over 65 years old are divorcing. And there's a trend.
The gray divorce.
That's the gray divorce.
Okay. Now, what's the number one reason these couples are choosing not to live out their final life, their final chapter together? Dee, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, it varies, but it comes down to a couple of things. By and large, discovering that they don't know each other after the kids have left the nest.
Mm-hmm. They focused on other things and not on developing and maintaining a relationship.
Called the empty nest syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so people did not focus on the relationship, right. Focus on raising the kids.
So now that the kids are gone, what do we do? And then what? You don't know. You don't know this person.
And maybe what you don't know. Like.
Right.
Hello.
So what am I willing to do? It seems easy to say, well, I don't want this anymore. And people are living longer. And the question becomes, do I want to spend the rest of my healthier years, because we're healthier and we're living longer? Do I want to be stuck with them?
So Dee, from the woman's from the wife's perspective, the woman's perspective in these gray divorces, is she feeling maybe that she made considerable sacrifices during the marriage and she wants a little freedom at this point now that the kids are gone?
It's a combination of things, but the research says that the woman by and large is the one who initiates the divorce.
That's what I'm thinking. There must be something about that being a wife for that many years that is not sitting well at the end of that time frame. So we've always heard that the couple stay together for the children, and then children grow up and go off to college or just move out and start their own lives, and mom and dad decide, okay,
I think that the wife has to look at, how am I being fulfilled? Perhaps the raising of the children and the taking care of the nest allowed her to be more fulfilled. But now that's done. What is there left for me to do? How can I make a difference now? What is my ongoing purpose? So all of those questions are things that now come up, and they're not sure as to what the answer is, or they don't like what they've come up with. So now it's like, what do I do?
Right.
So is there one race that this is more prominent in over another one?
No, it doesn't break down. We haven't found that to be the case.
The research that says this particular racial group does it more than this group. Not saying it doesn't exist, but we have not found it.
No, we haven't found it. But we do find that as a whole, Asians stay together more and Indians stay together more, or East Indians. Now, part of the East India we write in the book is
is different.
The cultural issues are different. So what we talk about in the book are a couple of things. One, how important it is for people to have a date night. Thought out early. My wife and I started when we were still early in our marriage, a couple who had been married 50 years said, make sure you have a date night every week. We said, we can't afford a date night. We had little children. They said, you don't need to spend money. Just make it intentional that y'all are together. So on Thursday nights, it was over 30 years ago, we would make Thursday night our date night at 9 o'clock. We'd watch L.A. Law and Hill Street Blues.
That was date night. That was a cheap date.
And we got Jiffy Pop popcorn. It cost us 49 cents. We popped that thing. We didn't have no microwave. And we had a date. And the two things we couldn't talk about were the kids and the bills. Talk about them. We'll only talk about it. And so it worked. And so what we've done also, keeping from arguing, we want to encourage everybody to go to our website, see our TED Talk. It's called How to Never Ever Argue Again in Marriage, because that could be an impact in these great divorces. And they've argued, they've held it down for the kids or the money, but then they were argumentative. So go to jollymarriage.com, watch the TED Talk. It's 12 minutes long, but it'll give you the four F's that we've employed that keep us from arguing, that everybody. And we had people who were on their way to divorce courts who said, we started using it and it changed our marriage. Jollymarriage.com.
And even recently, as of this weekend, we got a call. Yeah. A couple who've been married, 41 years. They celebrated their anniversary, and then they had a major stumble. And we talked them through the four F's.
Ty and Pam Harris. Now, you guys are college sweethearts. Pam, how did you know he was the one?
You know, it is so interesting that you asked me that, because I remember friends asking me, and of course, at the time, I'm 24 years old. Pam, how do you know that he's the one? And my answer, you know, is actually similar to what it was then. And that is when someone is willing to show you who they are from the very, very beginning. And that includes what is not said. That includes what is done and what is consistently shown in the way they become present with you. These are the things that evidently had more impact on me than I even realized at the time. Because my answer really is the same now. When you know, you just know. And it is linked to how it is that other person, in this case, it was Ty, you know, makes themselves present in ways that are not only verbal, you know, but are the very essence of who he was as a person, as a friend, as a man. So it's interesting to me that you ask that, because I noticed that my answer really is the same.
And it sounds like it sort of leads to what Dee was saying earlier, that these couples at the end of, you know, the long marriage, they realize they don't know each other. But it sounds like you had the opportunity to get to know Ty from the very beginning and really know him and like what apparently what you saw. So you're not trying to divorce as the years go by. Yeah. So now, Ty, Pam is clearly beautiful and brilliant. But there must have been something else that made you want to spend the rest of your life with her. Talk about it.
Wow. What made me want to spend the rest of my life with her? Well, first of all, you know, I think that you really have to like the person that you are trying to spend so much important time with. And once you establish that baseline, then you try to see what kinds of things you are compatible around. And, you know, Pam, anybody that knows her, I mean, she just has such an incredibly gentle spirit. She has a kind of an aura that was apparent from the very beginning. And so what I had to do was trust that inner voice that was telling me, hey, you know, you got something special here, even in light of all of the daily distractions that that work against that. And so I liked her from the very beginning. We became friends first. We made friendship the basis of our relationship. And then we built on that. And we would say to anybody, marry your best friend.
That's that's a big wow, because chapter number one in our book is friends first. Friends first before anything else. Friends first. That's the final. Great job. Great piece, Ty.
Well, Willie, I wish that we had your book back then. Yes. We've been making it up as we go along.
Maybe you can write a few chapters of your own.
Well, I don't know.
And add it to their next edition. But one of the biggest factors that lead to divorce is money. Now, what role did money play in your marriage, Ty and Pam?
Well, you know, I grew up in a household where we had to, it felt like we had to watch every dime. You know, we probably didn't, but that was my mom and dad's mindset. So, you know, we basically tried to be very careful and very cautious as it related to money. And my mother told me way, way, way back when, she said, you want
to... you're breaking up a little bit there. Ty.
Make sure that you have, you'll be able to have, you want to have everything that you need and some of what you want. Did I break up?
Okay. Yeah, but let me take a moment here just to give a little color commentary here. I worked, when I was at AU, I worked in the summers for the Department of Transportation at their warehouse. Who did I work with but Ty's father, Mr. Harris? And here's one of the things that Mr. Harris taught me, most gentle man, very gentle. He would sit at his desk and read his Bible on his breaks. He would read his Bible and he'd say, young man, you make God an important part of your life and you'll do well. When that's chapter number two, make God an equal part of your marriage. So Mr. Harris was an impactful person on me with that lesson. And I was at his home going service and at Mrs. Harris' home going service because they were people who trusted God and they made God an important part of their family. So friends first, then make God an equal part of your marriage. And number three, talk about everything. Talk about everything.
Okay, so talk, but apparently not argue. Willie and Dee's have
we disagree, they haven't argued
in 35 years. But
now people think we don't disagree. We disagree, but we just don't argue. There's a difference.
All right. So
money matters. So you could go on with that. Money matters. Chapter number nine or 10 is number nine. Money matters. You got to have a money system. And there are three systems. We won't go into it, but if you get the book, how you can find a money system that works for you and your spouse.
But you can't find a money system if you're not communicating.
Oh, hello.
It goes back to that. Yeah.
And of course, you have to find the actual money. But anyway. Yeah. All right.
We had to be on the same page where money was concerned. That was the hardest part, to have a meeting of the minds and kind of a strategy and a frame of reference. And core values for how we wanted to do that. And once we agreed on that, we were fine. But there was a lot of work getting to that.
How did you all talk things out? Not argue, but talk things out. What was your strategy there? We've always heard, never go to bed angry. You know, did you apply that rule, that wisdom, Todd? Pam, let me ask you about that. Pam.
Sure. I love the chance to be able to respond to that. I think that communication has always been a priority from my family all the way into my friendships with my female friends, and certainly in my relationship with Ty over the years. And that includes being able to communicate, not avoiding, but through the necessary points of disagreement, points of trying to get to a consensus. I think one of the things that I'm most proud of, that I feel most fulfilled about, is how we have grown through those growing edges of what it means to be able to communicate through challenge and use that as leverage for how it is that we get to solutions. That really energizes me when I think back over the years to how that has become an attribute more so than a deficit.
Yeah. Bernard, let me add something to that. We're going to get Willie's book because we still figuring out that arguing thing. All right. But I think that one of the things that has really helped us is once we began to trust each other and trust each other's motives as far as any particular discussion is concerned, we both came to the conclusion that we had each other's best interests in mind. Right. So that meant that we could disagree loudly, long, all of those things. But at the end of the day, we knew that we had made a bond to do what was ever best, what was ever in the best interest of us as a couple. Mm-hmm. So we have struck a balance between our individual needs and our needs as a couple. And sometimes we agree to disagree, but by putting God first, we know that we are always on the right path.
Yeah.
Amen.
Amen.
So some couples go through sort of a silent treatment with each other. I don't know how well that works out, but I know that it does happen. So let me ask you this, Ty and Pam. What advice would you give to a baby boomer couple that may be struggling with staying together? What's your secret? You've mentioned some very important things: trust, knowing the individual,
knowing and still figuring out. I'm glad to hear you all are still figuring it out. You're not giving up. Was divorce ever an option in either of your minds?
Well, you know, it's interesting because while we were still dating, a lot of our friends were already married. And by the time we got married, they were all divorced. So, you know, that was something that was in our face from the very beginning. And it was something that we knew we were going to have to navigate as a couple.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me say some about divorce, and I gotta get this one thing.
I told Dee
when we got married, divorce not an option. Now, if you want to get out of there, that you can get out of it. Here's a solution: die. You die, you good. Okay. Other than that, we in it for life.
Okay. Well, Ty and Pam Harris, always the cutest couple at the AU reunion. Happy 50th anniversary to you both, and may your celebrations next Saturday be filled with the love that you both exude wherever you go.
That's June, yes, June 15th, Verna. That's when our 50th wedding anniversary is on Saturday, indeed. June the 15th.
Yeah, I have my calendar marked.
Me too.
We're going back to the spot where it first happened.
Amen.
We're going back to Case Spiritual.
That are you.
Hey, we got married there too, by the way, just so you know.
Yes.
We got
married
there. Yes. Yes.
Very interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. All right. So Dr. Willie and Dee Jolly, host of the Jolly Marriage Show, which can be seen on Mondays at 9 p.m. on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you all for being guests this morning.
Thank you. And go get a free chapter. Go get a free chapter from the book at jollymarriage.com. Everybody, just go get a free chapter. And then if you get the book, get two copies and one for each of you so you can grow together. God bless y'all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Bernie, so much. Take care, Willie. Much
love. I love y'all. Love y'all.
Okay.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thank you to you, the listeners. And thank you to my engineer, Michael Masella. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Fay Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.
Amen.
Saturday marks 8 months of U.S.-Israeli genocide of the Palestinian people. A month ago, Biden said that the invasion of Rafah was a red line. But now the invasion of Rafah has continued for weeks, has expanded to the entire Gaza Strip. Instead of following through and stopping military aid to Israel, Biden has authorized billions more in weapon shipments to be used to kill and massacre Palestinians. Biden can draw the line, but we can. On June 8th, we will come together from across the country and surround the White House wearing red and raising our demands high. We will show the world that we are the red line. We demand an immediate ceasefire, an immediate end to the siege on Gaza, the freedom of all Palestinian prisoners, and an end to the occupation of Palestine. Viva Palestina Libre.
ShutItDownForPalestine.org.
Greetings. This is Interim General Manager Miyuki Williams. Thanks to all who donated during the spring membership drive. Thanks also to those who came out to the Tacoma Station Happy Hour and our open house, allowing us to meet those we serve. If you are unable to donate during the drive, you can donate anytime at wpfwfm.org. With your support, WPFW can continue offering engaging and insightful programming, making the world better, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink, Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW DFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
WPFW's 2024 election to seat members to represent you on the local station board has started. Renew your membership by making a minimum donation of $25 or completing 3 hours of eligible volunteer work by June 30th in order to be a candidate, nominate candidates, or vote. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information or call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor.
Peace, everyone. I'm Brother Jamil, and in the Yardbird Suites tradition established by our dear brother Askia Muhammad, we continue every Tuesday morning from 5 to 8, playing some things you've never heard before and also playing some old favorites. But we